Production. Recorded live.
Hello, everyone. This is Carl Shinneman, president and founder of ReviewLess, and welcome to another edition of ESI Bites. We're alongside the Honorable Judge John Facciola, retired U.S. Magistrate Judge from the United States District Court of Columbia. We're going to attempt to offer information, insights, and ideas about e-discovery innovation from national speakers on electronic discovery and other related topics at a price everyone can afford, which is free and available whenever you're interested in listening to it, which is whenever you hit the play button on your device. Today we have an interesting and very topical show on data security, and we're going to go through some of the nuts and bolts of data security and data privacy issues, with CIA Director John Brennan recently being hacked and a number of other high-profile health insurance companies. It's something we seem to read about every week, and given the legal risks associated with not safeguarding certain personal types of records, such as medical or financial information, lawyers are becoming much more aware of this hot topic. You know, they're targets, too, of being hacked, so it's I guess, very sensitive to them as well. We have an outstanding panel, and I say that all the time, but this time it's clearly very true, of some of the leading voices on data privacy issues, and our participants for this really interesting show have extremely long bios, so I've taken an editorial license with them, but they're all well known nationally. I suggest you Google them. They're at the forefront of this topic. First in the corner to the right of me, I've got Sharon Nelson, the founder of Sensei, an information technology, digital forensics, and information security firm. Sharon's one of the top e-discovery speakers nationally, and if memory serves me right, did one of our first CSI Bites podcasts with Judge Facciola, who was also a guest on the show in 2009 on e-discovery for small law firms. Sharon's a longtime friend, writes one of the most respected blogs in the industry, Ride the Lightning, and frequently publishes books for the ABA on e-discovery and information security topics. She's an attorney and served on the ABA's Cybersecurity Legal Task Force, and is on its Standing Committee on Technology and Information Systems, among many, many other committees. Tim Opsitnik is the founder of Juranov, which he started in 2000 and has been involved with the founding of the Sedona Conference, the Georgetown Advanced E-Discovery CLE programs, and I might also add ESI Bites. Tim cut his teeth in the early days of e-discovery and product liability litigation, and after a successful career practicing law, eventually started Juranov, which is an e-discovery forensics and data security company. Glad to have you on the show, Tim. And John Simic is the vice president of Sensei Enterprises, where he works with Sharon Nelson. John has a national reputation as a digital forensics technologist and has testified as an expert witness throughout the United States. He holds the prestigious Certified Information Systems Security Professional, CISSP. He also is a certified handheld examiner, certified Novell engineer, Microsoft certified professional. Lots of certifications. Let's just leave it at that. John is also a member of the High-Tech Crime Council or Network, as well as the ABA and the Fairfax Bar Association. He's the co-host of the Legal Talk Network podcast, Digital Detectives, and a co-author of Encryption Made Simple for Lawyers with the American Bar Association in 2015, Locked Down Information Security for Lawyers, an ABA publication in 2012, and numerous other chapters and books and other materials that he's author, and he's a speaker on information security, legal technology, and electronic evidence throughout the country. And, of course, my co-host is Judge Facciola, who retired as a United States Magistrate Judge in the United States District of Columbia last year, where he served since 1997 and is well-known in the field for his thought-provoking opinions. And speaking is done nationally on e-discovery, and I'd like to say, from what I've heard from other people, the podcast he's been doing on ESI Bites. Judge Facciola has been a mentor for many in the field of e-discovery and is active in e-discovery education at Georgetown. So let's start the show here. Sharon, why is cybersecurity so important to an organization today?
Well, Carl, first of all, thank you very much for inviting us to be with you. There really are only two kinds of businesses today, those who have been breached and those who will be breached. And right now the FBI has just begun recently to lecture that those two kinds of businesses are converging into just one, businesses that have been breached before and will be breached again, which is kind of sad. But the truth is that we have this quaint old mantra, it seems quaint now, of keeping the barbarians at the gate, and that mantra is dead. A sophisticated hacker with sophisticated tools is going to get in if they want to get in. So the new mantra is detect, respond, and recover. Recovering is certainly key because, as Bruce Schneier has said, if a major law firm suffers a major breach and it becomes public, it could end up having to close its doors. I think law firms have such a trust issue with clients that if a major breach did go public, you really might see a mass exodus of clients and you might see the law firm fold. But we've certainly seen other major businesses be breached and recover, not without damage, but they have recovered. But it has become almost an obsession in the C-suite that cybersecurity is a priority.
I just thought of this while you were saying this. Do you see a heightened risk of law firms hosting their own data in e-discovery, hosting the repository, given the fact that they're a target?
Yes, absolutely. And the worst part is we've started to see very recently, we have started to see a huge upswing in people producing an e-discovery via Dropbox, which is not very secure. So they're not only doing stupid stuff like that, but they've got all this dark data hanging around. They've done productions.
They don't know what they have.
So how can you secure what you don't know what you have and you don't know where it is? So, yeah, it's a huge, huge, huge issue, and I think competence in e-discovery is a topic all of its own, and I know our friend Dave Reese is actually lecturing today or tomorrow.
Right now.
He's lecturing on that very subject. So, yeah, that's really important.
Dave would have been on the show if he wasn't lecturing. He's also well-known in the field. So, anyway.
Tim, why should a company, no matter what its size, maintain cybersecurity as an ongoing process?
Well, I think there are a number of reasons. They're fairly straightforward. The first is business interruption, where business needs to stay up and running and they need to do their day job. And if they're off tracking down and trying to figure out something with respect to a breach or other interruption in business, it takes away from them what they're supposed to be doing. Next is theft of intellectual property or money. These are things which are very important to an organization, followed closely by loss of confidential information, trade secret, or personal information that they may have requirements to keep confidential. Then, of course, there's the regulatory requirements and the legal liabilities and after that. And I put these not necessarily in any order of importance, but the last one that I'd like to talk about is one which was already touched on in the prior question, which is the reputational damage. This is one that I really don't think is reversible. This is one that has a significant impact, and as I think Sharon pointed out in the first question, at least with respect to trusted advisors such as law firms, could in fact bring about the demise of an organization because they are a trusted advisor, and if they make mistakes in this area, which is an ancillary business to them, could result in their demise.
Tim, if I may, what if a company says, "Oh, give me a break, Tim. We're so small. Why do we have to worry about that stuff?" That's Microsoft.
I get that question all the time, and what I tell clients is, I hear you, and I get it. And what I would say is, and we've heard these words before as lawyers, you have to do what's reasonable for your organization, and you have to do what's proportional for your organization. And okay, maybe you as an organization can't afford your own person with the certifications, for example, that John has to lead the security, but you've got some obligation to do something. And, right now what I see is that companies are using that as an excuse to frankly not move the ball forward. And what I'd like to see is that companies just say, okay, there's some simple things that we can do here to get us 80% of the way there. And I just don't think that that's a good excuse. I mean, I'm not saying that they have to look like Microsoft, but they have to do some things and they have to have a plan. Some of these things that they need to do are very simple and don't cost a lot of money.
So, Sharon, what ethical and legal obligations does a company or firm face when it comes to maintaining the standard compliance or security requirements?
Well, businesses are one thing, but I think law firms, they have a much higher stake because they have a duty to be competent. And 17 states thus far, as of today, have adopted the ABA model rules 1.1 and 1.6 with the changes stating that they have to be competent to assess the risks and the benefits of the technology they use. The new comments to the rule 1.6 make it clear that law firms have a lot of factors to balance. In fact, if a lawyer is listening to this podcast and hasn't read those comments, they need to do so and do so at once because the states really are adopting very quickly. Businesses, of course, all businesses have duty under federal and state regulations and laws, as Tim mentioned. And, of course, we have contractual requirements. We sign a contract and we may find that we're going to exercise a higher level of security, and that happens a lot. And particularly the health and the banking industry have very strict legal requirements, and those requirements are backed up with teeth about how they're going to protect their data. So there's just so many laws. There's SOX, there's HIPAA, HITECH, Gramm-Leach, Bliley. I mean, the list just goes on and on. And then the states have all their own laws as well. So it's very formidable to meet this challenge.
John, in light of what Sharon just says, I assume you confront the problem that a regulatory or self-imposed industry may have a set of standards which overlap or in a worst case, conflict. What can a company do when it's faced with this multiplicity of standards?
I guess first off, if you're the Microsofts of the world, you've got folks that are, you know, in-house. As Tim mentioned, not everybody can afford to have that kind of expertise, but certainly if you don't have it, you're going to need some experts, both from the legal side as well as from the technical side. So there's essentially two kinds. There's standards that are requirements and those that are optional. So if we have a legal obligation, Sharon touched on some of those. If you're processing or holding health information, you know, you're subject to HIPAA and HITECH, those kinds of things. If you're dealing in the financial industry, you have certain regulatory requirements there too. If you're processing credit cards, you need to deal with that. There's PCI DSS that you have to have the technical infrastructure in order to conform with that. So you have all of those things to deal with. Then those are required things, but there are optional ones as well, optional standards. ISO 27001, so as far as security goes. So, and you can differentiate yourself there. Some of these things do, in fact, overlap. And if you've already addressed some of them with one of the standards or one of the regulations, then you certainly don't need to build it twice. But again, you're going to need some expertise or folks with expertise in those areas in order to make those determinations.
And it's interesting that of the AmLaw 100, 28 firms have now attained that ISO certification.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a train we weren't seeing boarded quite so quickly before.
That's interesting.
If I may, to Sharon and John, just quickly, is the cost of doing that formidable, even for smaller companies?
You know, that you're going to laugh, but I was going to look at that to see if we could
do no, it.
Whether I think it's pretty formidable,
it is.
And you have to have an annual audit. But I was going to
yes.
go back and actually check that out. But if you're going to have to have an annual audit done, it seems to me that probably this is appropriate only for the larger firms. What I think is appropriate for the smaller businesses and law firms is to comply with the NIST standards.
Right.
That seems to me to be a better solution for them. And they have small business standards, which are published on their websites, along with a lot of guidelines and commentary. So that's where I would go as a smaller law firm or business.
Being a smaller company that does, you know, some higher profile types of, you know, matters sometimes, you know, the approach I've taken, even though I'm an attorney and, you know, you try to keep up with all this stuff, but you only have a certain amount of resources, is to check every single tool that I use and ask before I adopt it into our process what their, as a vendor providing that technology that we're going to use to, you know, either communicate or have data, what level of encryption do they have? and let the person selling me the tools make me comfortable that we're going beyond reasonable. And, you know, that's sort of the common sense approach. If you know you're in a sensitive area, but you can't go out and hire IBM or, you know, some massive company, is to evaluate the risk and say, where are the risks? What can I do to lock it down? And then let your clients press you with questions. Are you doing the right thing? That's your audit.
Yeah, but Carl, a lot of the vendors, though, are going to identify what regulations or what rules or what standards their products conform to. So they've done that heavy lifting, already. They've certified that it's HIPAA compliant. They've certified that it meets government FIPS, you know, encryption standards, those kinds of things. Now, you're going to need to do, as Sharon said, the 27001 ISO standard has this annual audit deal because technology changes all the time. Well, the vendor is going to have to make sure that they conform with that as well. So in your call-up, you're going to need to go and ask the vendor again. Does the data center conform to these, standards or not?
But Judge Fetchel asks a great question here because I deal with this constantly with small to mid-size law firms and accounting firms, and that is what, you know, they want to be certified, and people are asking them, have you had a SOC 2 type SAE 16 audit, or what sort of audit have you had? And for most of these organizations, spending $25,000 or $50,000 to have these audits or become compliant with the 27001 audit, it's just not something they can do.
True.
So they do need some direction, and we do need to find a solution which is affordable, economical, and moves the ball forward. And frankly, right now we don't have it. Sharon, your suggestion of the NIST framework I think is a great idea. I think that's the direction we need to head, because otherwise companies are refusing to do it because it's cost prohibitive.
Well, they can also do an independent third-party audit, which is much less costly as long as you're using a smaller firm and not one of the mega firms. And that's been a solution that a lot of clients have accepted. They just don't want the law firm self-certifying, but an independent third-party audit,
right.
Many of them are willing to accept that.
So, Tim, are companies that maintain the standard requirements for compliance or security actually protected?
That's a great question. This is a sort of a pet peeve of mine. You know, too often we let the tail wag the dog, and we worry way too much about regulation. Frankly, most of the time, the regulators, they don't understand your industry, and I guarantee you they don't understand your company. The approach that I prefer to take, which ensures compliance, is that the company itself does its own introspection about what it needs to be secure. You need to first think about what you need to be secure. Every company and industry is different, and in fact, you'd rather be unique in terms of how you approach it, because that uniqueness is, in fact, its own sense of security. You don't want to look like everyone else. And then when you're done, after you follow that approach, then you can look at the regulations, and you can check the boxes and make sure that you've done what the regulations require you to do. But I would start first with what you think is important for your organization. Now, it's, of course, a little more complex than that. You need some leadership on how to get there. But I would prefer to approach it that way rather than from a compliance standpoint.
And I always think that, too, people forget to mine the gap. And no one is ever really 100% secure. So you mine the gap by getting the appropriate cyber insurance. And they forget sometimes how important cyber insurance is. They don't understand whether they have it. They don't understand the exclusions. But you have to take the best security you can afford to provide and do provide, and then you've got to cover yourself the rest of the way with cyber insurance.
Well, it's a risk and value proposition, really. It's you have to manage the risk and what's your vulnerability. How valuable is your data? And certainly that's the most valuable data is the one that you want to protect the most, and that's where you're going to invest the most.
And a recent study showed, because we've been talking about the smaller businesses and law firms because we worry more about them, but a recent study has shown that a cyber insurance rider, and it's usually a rider, will cost about $10,000 a year for $1 million of insurance. And I know that's true because we are, Sensei is a small firm, and that's almost exactly what we paid. So that's probably on target.
I'm going to skip ahead if you don't mind, because I think we've covered some areas. But for Sharon and Tim, it has been said of organizations that they have a wonderful capability of forming a firing squad in a circle. How do you bring home to them that this is a responsibility of management? And conversely, how do you train people to take this seriously?
Well, I let me just say first that this is a top-down strategy. If management and doesn't provide leadership in this area, it frankly doesn't get done. It has to begin at the top, and anybody that tries to do it otherwise is just wasting time and money. That would be the first and most important takeaway that I would have on that.
And Sharon, how do you get this to permeate an organization's ethos? So people who come in are sensitive to this and appreciate it. It is an important management concern.
Well, you do. I think Tim had it spot on. That was pretty much what I was going to say. But it is the creation of a culture, and that means that you've got to do a lot of training. You have to have your IT professionals and IS professionals. You know, they're not necessarily going to be listened to without that management buy-in. And sometimes it's more important to bring in third parties because they're more apt to listen to people from outside. The IT professionals themselves, if it's IT and not IS, and most firms don't have IS people, specific IS people, IT professionals can be very dangerous because they think they know information security, and they really don't. I mean, that's a specialty.
And they have God keys.
And they have administrator rights to everything, so they have the God rights to the network. And we have folks, we have employees that say, I want this device and these apps. I don't care what our policies say. The millennials just do what they want to do. They'll end run the policies and the technology to get to do whatever they want. And, in fact, I just saw recently there was a CLE for lawyers called You're Not the Boss of Me, Managing Millennials at Your Law Firm. I mean, this is a much bigger problem than people imagine.
No, that's exactly correct. My own children tell me all the time, Dad, I don't know what you're so worried about. You know, this information is already out there. Why do you get so upset about the security of these issues? You know, and I go ballistic. I go nuts.
I think on a prior podcast, I think it was Judge Waxy, if my memory serves me right, Judge Facciola, who talked about his concern about judges even evaluating some of these, you know, personal information cases. And, you know, there has been erosion in our culture of what really is private.
Be aware, however, that the federal judiciary has been involved in information security, and each court has an information security officer. And what Sharon and Tim have said, and John has said, it has to permeate in the organization. From the law clerk who doesn't see anything wrong with playing fantasy football on his computer, to people who post their password with a yellow sticky over their computers, and this business of permeating down, I guess, must drive you poor people crazy.
So, looking at where we're at right now on this, Sharon, you know, other than the people who work directly for an organization, do companies really have a handle on who's got their data?
No. I could stop there and give you a one-word answer, but I know you don't want me to do that. I think it's getting worse and worse. Storage is so cheap that many businesses just move colossal amount of data when they get new devices. They don't have a good destruction policy. They have shadow data they don't know they have, and it's everywhere. Employees put company data on their devices, their personal devices, and in their personal clouds. They've acknowledged in surveys that they do that. They forget what data is on what devices, especially flash drives and phones. And sometimes they have no idea in the world that their phones are keeping voicemails that they've listened to or documents that they've read because they punch the home button. They don't save anything. But on an iPhone, that is now kept on the device. As for third parties who have access to their data, their vendor management at most businesses is simply deplorable. That's been a huge subject at conferences this year simply because people aren't doing it. And the big kahuna, of course, of this kind of breach is Target. Its breach was caused by giving more access than was warranted to a heating and cooling vendor who had itself been compromised, allowing the compromise to spread to Target. It's the wild, wild west out there. There's no sheriff in town.
Yeah, if you don't know what you have and where it's at, you can't protect it. And that's first and foremost. You know, the auditors have something they do called a risk analysis. We do something similar, which is called a data audit. But I try to give somebody, you know, a few sheets of paper which outlines where they keep their data and what their data is, what type of data it is, and you know, where it's at. Because when you know where it's at and you can get it down to a few sheets of paper, and I'm, of course, for larger organizations, you know, it might be 10 sheets of paper, but then they can make good decisions about how to protect it. But half these organizations have no idea where their data is. And worse, there are those out there who think they know, and they're wrong.
But I think it's more than just data, though, Tim. It's also devices. They have no clue what's connected to their network. They have no idea what the entry points and exit points are or where the bleed points are. I mean, the IRS themselves has 1,400 XP machines that they have no clue where the hell they are.
Yeah, they can't find them. And your whole network is only as strong as its weakest link. So it's not good that they have these XP machines that are connected to their network.
Yeah, in fact, there was a study that came out recently I saw that was put out about the waste of electricity, because there are organizations that have tens of hundreds, thousands of computers running that nobody knows what's on them. And so they're afraid to shut them off because they don't even know who owns them and who's running them. They don't know what they control. So they've got them running in their data centers. They've got them running in their offices. They don't know what's on them. But this article came at it from the standpoint is we are wasting $1 billion a year on energy because these computers are running. I would say what the real risk is probably not the energy, but the fact that, you know, these computers have legacy data that nobody needs, and we ought to be shutting them down.
Yeah, but those are the remote access points for the Russians.
Yeah. I'm going to make a lot of money. I'm going to go to the big law firms and say, I'll bet you $1,000 you cannot tell me what you have at Iron Mountain. Think I'd win that bet?
Oh, yeah.
In a heartbeat.
Because the truck pulls up and then it leaves, and nobody on earth knows what it just took. That's the one that always gets me. And I guess we're all counting that all of this stuff is in a cave somewhere in Pennsylvania. If we get lucky, there'll be a small, tiny earthquake. Close the cave, and we don't have to worry about this anymore. But right now, if you ask, I mean, I had that exact case. During cross-examination, they asked this guy where the data was, and he said, we have a cloud provider, and he destroys it every 90 days. The lawyer learned that during cross-examination of his own witness.
Oh, my word.
And I'll never forget the look on his face. It was mind-boggling. Carl, why don't you pick up here? I'm afraid we've abandoned, as usual, we threw it out the window and decided to have some fun, but I still have some questions. Go ahead.
Well, you know what? You just threw one out there that I see here on the list. You know, you're relying on this Iron Mountain or this deposition, and you find out something that's happening. So, Tim, you know, what can a company do to ensure their third-party vendor, if they know who they are, maintains a high level of security?
Well, you need to audit your third-party vendors at some level. And again, this gets back to what's reasonable, proportionate size of the organization and size of the third party. But, you know, you may have to do an on-site inspection. It may be as simple as sending them a two-page sheet of paper which asks them some questions and have them answer it. But you need to do it at some level. But what's as equally as important to that is you have to understand that that is simply a point-in-time review. So you need to do that on a periodic basis, and you need to be vigilant about it because, you know, what somebody's doing one day, they won't do the next, and you need to find out what those changes are, because what scares me most in with respect to security is what I don't know. And so you need to get a process in place that allows you to figure that out.
Can I ask the three of you this question? Several, including Sedona, Tim, you worked on this, I don't know if Sharon and John did, but Sedona's recently had a publication. I've seen, for example, the Pennsylvania Bar, many very well-respected entities giving a list of contractual terms that should be in the contract between the law firm and the vendor. But I'm afraid a lot of lawyers are telling me that's like trying to negotiate the contract when I rent a car from Hertz. It's presented to me on a take-it-or-leave-it basis. And since I can't possibly pay for the storage of this self myself, I have to take it because I just can't leave it. Do law firms really have any bargaining power in this enterprise?
Judge, this is Tim, and let me see this. It's a great analogy because I just went through renting a car in Aruba and what the experience was like. And I can tell you that as much as you argue with them, they won't change the contract. And for the vast majority of organizations, they're simply not big enough for these third-party vendors to care. They won't change the contracts. There is no negotiation. It is take it or leave it. There are exceptions, and you know, which is one of the reasons why organizations move much more to a private-type cloud, and they create their own cloud and their own ways of storing things. Because it's been my experience that it sounds great, but in reality, it's not workable.
Well, it can be if you go to smaller providers, and a good example is...
Well, that's kind of what Tim's talking about.
Yeah, if you want to put your data in the cloud, you're not going to get anybody negotiating with you from Amazon. It is take it or leave it. But our clients are in a smallish data center in Reston, Virginia, and we went through three rounds of negotiations. They wanted the business, and the contract changed very markedly. And those changes were all in compliance with lawyers' ethical rules, and that's what I was trying to achieve. So if you are in a smaller place, you may indeed be able to negotiate. The large vendors are just too problematic. It is take it or leave it. So we seek out smaller vendors of quality and do some investigation. And if they can make it workable and work with lawyer ethics, then great. And they know that that's smart. They've actually enjoyed being able to say, this is the contract we can offer you. So there's
that,
an advantage.
Microsoft doesn't or Amazon
right.
doesn't.
There's a marketing advantage for the smaller vendors. And when you point that out, they do get happier to work with you.
Mm-hmm. That's a very, very interesting explanation. It always mystified me as whether you did have any bargaining power. That's very valuable. Carl?
Well, you know, we talked now about some of the cloud issues, and I remember we talked a little bit. We touched upon bring your own device issues, which I think everyone struggles with. So, Tim, companies that are faced with advancing technology on an everyday basis, and this whole bring your own device trend that's out there. What are the risks associated with bring your own device, and is it worth it? Because we talked about some of the risks, but you want your workers to be productive, and new devices are sometimes a heck of a lot more productive. So what do you do?
Well, I'm going to start this by deferring to John in one respect. John and I were on a panel last year at Georgetown, and John said it's not bring your own device; it's bring your own disaster. I want to make sure that John is giving credit for that joke. But so yeah, it is a reality. Companies need to look at themselves and say, what does my culture bear? Am I one which is highly regulated, and what are the risks? So if you're trying to create creativity, and you're trying to hire lots of millennials, you're going to have issues if you don't give freedom and you don't allow BYOD. I mean, this is a cultural thing that organizations need to weigh the risks of. And the risks are huge. I mean, I just can't even begin to tell you. I mean, we could spend hours talking about the risks, so I don't really want to get into it. But more than anything, I just think the organization needs to do it. They need to talk about it and they need to understand maybe there's some things at the margin that they could do. But the risks are enormous in this area.
Sharon and John, just so you can kick in, I have been on the panel, and I believe the gentleman was general counsel to Office Depot, and he said they have simply outlawed them.
Yeah,
and
so,
he said
so
it was the only way I could sleep at night. But I got a class full of millennials, and one of their assignments was to draft a BYOD policy. It is a very hard sell with that generation for the reasons that Tim just gave. I know I've got grandchildren that age. Is this an insoluble problem, or are corporations going to have to get a lot tougher than they are?
I think they do have to get a lot tougher, and we ban personal devices on the network here. That way we have full control. We issue devices, and that way we can manage those devices, do what we like with those devices. And for those people who argue that it saves money to let them bring their own device, that to me is a crazy argument, because once you get a data breach caused by that device being connected to your network, you've lost any potential savings that you've racked up. So it doesn't make any sense. I do think they need to be tougher, and although the millennials might not like it, I mean, they're simply causing more and more problems. Now they're not only bringing their own device, they're bringing their own network, and that's bring your own nightmare, and they're bringing their own cloud, and that's bring your own catastrophe. So now you have more lines, Tim. I mean, there's no end to what they will do. So you have to police what goes on in your own network.
But I think it makes a difference, though, as to firm size, company size. Larger companies certainly can afford the technology, or at least some technology, to be put in place to help manage and control a BYOD environment, to minimize those risks and create those sandboxes on those devices,
and that's
all of that stuff.
The large firms do that.
Smaller ones won't invest and can't, because it's cost prohibitive to invest in the actual technology, but as a minimum they're going to have a policy. But I think key at the end of the day, with any BYOC, BYON, BYOD policy that you implement, is accountability. There has to be some consequence for violating the policy, whether they violate it as a result of a technology failure, or they violate it because you don't have any technology, but you just say you can't do such and such. They've got to be held accountable. We don't see much of that.
Go ahead, Judge.
At a recent conference I attended, one of the lawyers was explaining, I think she was UBS, internally they can detect that their employees, BYOD, are getting into the network. Now, and that triggers a notice to them of the impropriety of what they're doing. I guess what I'm asking is, Tim, John, and Sharon, you can set this up so those who would use BYOD and threaten security are prohibited from doing so by the network itself rejecting what they're trying to do. Or is that a pipe dream?
No, it's only achievable for most people if they have enough money, and so it's, you can achieve that with the larger firms. You can't achieve it with the smaller firms. It's not an easy solution. So for the smaller ones, you're better off banning them.
You may be able to detect that they hooked a personal device to your network, but not necessarily control what they do with it.
That's correct.
But I want to again add. I mean it. There are lots of people making the opposite decision and are fully aware of the risk. There are lots of people that says, you know, we make our money by making our employees happy and creative, and we're willing to take the risk. We're willing to give them the things that they want so that they make us successful as a business. And I don't want to say that that's a bad decision. You know, the lawyers are often accused of saying, you know, you got to follow the rules. And, you know, companies out there are weighing the risks differently.
I want to jump in. Yeah, good.
I think it's a two-way street. If the company provides, for want of a better word, a primitive system that defeats efforts to be productive, I'm hard-pressed to understand how they can complain when their employees try to make things better. That's an aspect of this as well. I mean, BYOD came in, didn't it, because the existing technology that the employees had was not meeting their needs. That's a part of management's concern as well, and that's a legitimate concern, isn't it?
So I'm going to try to ask a question that sort of on the fly here, and I'm amazed when you do this, Judge Facciola, when you pull these sort of global thoughts together. At the same time, my cell phone is ringing. Awesome. That's just destroyed the question. But anyway, no. So here's my question. I'm feeling a little old now at this point, because I remember back in eDiscovery in 2004, we looked at Zuba Lake and we looked at the new rules and we said, oh my God, the world's ending. We have to collect and we have to preserve everything, because there was this fear of being sanctioned. And then, you know, we fast forward to now, and now we're looking at proportionality, and we're trying to, you know, react to, you know, the costs of trying to do all of this. And in my space, you know, we're more of a mobile, you know, company that's using newer tools, but we always keep our eye on, you know, encryption and things like that. But we don't host any data. But I'm talking to regulated companies who confide in me that they can't access their own data at times anymore, because it's gotten so complicated and locked down that the data now, that at some point someone's going to have to look at the cost, and it's not at their pay grade to make that decision. Uh-huh. You know, are we running the risk? Because the whole first half of this podcast was scary. It sounded a lot like 2004. You know,
if I can't underline your point, I had some oral surgery, and my oral surgeon is completely mechanized, and I've had an interest over the years in electronic records. And Tim, John, and Sharon, I must tell you, the doctors are complaining that it's getting more and more difficult to get the clinical information they need to treat the pain, the patients. Isn't there a danger that this gets so complicated it brings the system to a halt?
You know, they said the same thing about encryption. And all of a sudden, encryption got made easy and pretty cheap and simple for a lawyer to use. So I would argue that we just haven't sorted it all out yet. Encryption has largely been sorted out so that even a small firm lawyer can afford it and use it. They can click on an encrypt and send button. They get that. What we now need to figure out is simpler means of multi-factor authentication and ways to access data, and that's coming. It's not here yet. I would agree with you, it's not here yet. But if we made encryption so doggone easy, I'm sure that we're going to be able to make other stuff easy too, just not today.
So I would begin by saying that I agree with your premise. In fact, I remember when you first asked the question, we were at a Sedona Working Group 11, the first meeting in San Diego about 4 years ago, and I remember you posed that same question at the time. And I told you a story about, you know, a circumstance that I went through with my son recently. And, you know, the bottom line is,
I remember that.
I want those doctors to have immediate access to that information, and I'm okay with them taking some risks to get that information more quickly. If a doctor's in the operating room and he's got some idea and he needs to check with and consult with a fellow professional at another university, and he's texting them, am I going to complain because he's saving my son's life that he violated HIPAA? I don't think so. And so, you know, I know technology will eventually solve these problems. Hell, they got us into it. They'll eventually come up with solutions. People are working on it. But I think we got to give people the benefit of the doubt. And too often, the law wants to penalize those people when in reality, they were just trying to do their jobs more effectively.
And that's sort of where I come down on this, that at the end of the day, if something bad happens, someone's going to be judging you based on the steps you took. And as long as you are doing, in my sense, you know, this is me, the entrepreneur speaking, a reasonable cost-benefit analysis, and you can explain your actions for what, you know, what you were doing, and that you thought through the risks, you know, I think that that's it to some extent. You know, Sharon, you'd mentioned, you know, buying, you know, having the cyber insurance. A form of insurance is always trying to be reasonable when you're taking a step that's dealing with something that could have some risk, and thinking it through and having an answer on why you did that.
But one of the things we've discovered recently, and there's a new case on this, is basically the insurer said, we don't cover stupid. So you can't say that you've taken reasonable steps at this point in time if you haven't got encrypted portable devices, mobile devices. That's one of those things where
You're putting PII on the internet and clear text.
And that happened in this case. And so the insurer fundamentally said, we don't cover
stupid.
And so now they have all these exclusions. So you do have to be reasonable, and you can't hide behind, I did this, this, and this, when there are so many other known modest or free security measures that you could have, should have taken.
But
well,
Tim, I think to get to your point, you know, as well, and Sharon's, is that we're moving more and more to where the technologies that we're using are, they're in fact going to protect the data. We're heading to an encryption by default world. It's going to be on automatically so that that doctor that's texting the message, you know what, that's going to be an encrypted text. He's not going to have to do anything different. We're getting there slowly, sooner and sooner, but, you know, the iPhones are encrypted by default when you put a PIN on there. That's pissing off the government. That I think, is right on the mark. As more and more as we move forward, we're going to begin seeing these kinds of security things in place that are, they're going to be transparent to the user.
Well, I'm looking over what we wanted to cover. I think we've covered a heck of a lot here. Is there anything else that that the three of you would like to add, looking at our sort of outline that maybe we didn't cover? And maybe we'll just go around to the three of you and start with Sharon and then Tim and then John.
All right, let me think about it. I think probably the most fascinating thing I saw recently was the fact that the large law firms, are the AmLaw 200, 250, that they are spending 9%, John?
1.9, yeah.
1.9% of gross revenues on cybersecurity. You compare that to 10 years ago, and that's an amazing number. It ramps up to $7 million. In some cases, a year that they're willing to spend. Now, they're being forced by clients in part, and in part, I think some of them are just trying to get ahead of this data breach problem and security issues and use that for marketing to assure clients that, yes, we are keeping your data safe. There's some of both. But I think that's an interesting movement, as well as information governance, which is a huge umbrella involving everything about your data, and cybersecurity is kind of a subset of that. But to really get a handle on your data and to make sure you are, in fact, covering the risk by some combination of technology and the insurance and training. We never want to forget. I have one slide that says training, 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 and have I mentioned training? Because that's really how they successfully get in most of the time. Someone will click on an attachment or a link in an email, and they need to be able to be trained to not do that, not to be stupid.
Yeah, this is Tim. I'll start by saying this is an appropriate topic for Friday the 13th. as I just glanced at the calendar and noticed. But to follow up on the point that Sharon just made, you know, I attend a lot of seminars today that are organized by law enforcement and by, you know, people from the NSA and the FBI. And, you know, these people, they see these sovereign actors, North Korea and China and Russia and these hackers all the time. So to them, you know, everything that deals with cybersecurity is issues of national security and things like that. But the reality is that the vast majority of data breaches occur by intentional acts or accidental acts of your own employees and by third parties with whom you have control of, who has your data. And so you don't have control over those hackivists, but you do have control over your own employees. You do have control over third parties. And to Sharon's point, why training is so important is because it actually goes to the heart of where most of the breaches occur. And so you can have a significant effect on diminishing your risks by training your employees and by auditing your third parties. These are people you have some control over. You don't have control over the North Koreans as much as you would like. So, I mean, I would say focus on training. That's just something that I think, as Sharon has hit on, is really important here.
And I would echo that as well, Tim. It's and that goes along the lines of the constantly evolving landscape that we're dealing with. At least an annual review of your technology and the attack vectors change. And that's another reason you need to keep training the employees. I mean, let's look at ransomware and the infections that are happening around the world, and particularly in law firms. I mean, in our own area here, in 1 week, there were 4 law firms that got hit with ransomware because the employees clicked on stuff they shouldn't have. The things have been, and there's variance now. So what you told the employees to do 6 months ago and how to recognize it is different because there's different ransomware out there. So that training element is huge, I think. And that's really what works in the cyberspace arena.
So that's
constant.
Clients come to me all the time and say, I want you to conduct social engineering on our organization. It might be a remote phishing attempt or something. And what I tell them is the results are going to be terrible. You're wasting your money. Just spend your money on training. Because I guarantee you the results are going to be terrible. So you don't need to run the test. So I really believe that money spent on training, and there's a lots available on the internet. You know, you can do it. You can have people come on site and do it. But there's a lot of things that can be done with respect to training. And so I think that's and be proactive on these issues. I think proactivity and the top-down strategy are things that I'd like to leave people with, thoughts I'd like to leave them with.
Well, I want to thank our guests here, Sharon, Tim, and John, for joining Judge Facciola and myself today here on ESI Bytes for this fascinating discussion. It's always great to have speakers such as yourself who understand an area so well provide this information. It's been very entertaining at the same time. I'd like to suggest to our listeners, if they have any questions about this show or other programs at ESI Bytes, to feel free to email me at kas@reviewless.com. I'd also like to thank our sponsor, Jurnov. Hey, Tim, thanks for their continued support of ESI Bytes and hosting it. And to the listeners, if you've enjoyed this podcast, I'd encourage you to go to www.esibytes.com with a Y for a complete list of our shows. And as we always say, come to ESI Bytes to learn more about eDiscovery before ESI bites you back. This is Carl Shinneman, President and Founder of ReviewLess, wishing you a nice day.